Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver Weather State Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
And Matt, today we are taking over the CBC. Not really, but we do have CBC financial guru, Mark Ting.
That's right. Mark Ting, fan favorite, back on the show. He's also a partner at Foundation Wealth.
Yes.
He was also on the live event.
He was.
Mark Ting, yeah, a couple cold ones with the financial guru there. That was a good time.
Yeah, I really enjoy the CBC. I hate eating their lunch, but really, I mean, we're coming for Michael Enright next.
Michael, yeah, CBC Sunday edition.
Yeah, I'm a huge Enright fan.
Michael Enright's a...
I've modeled my whole personality around Michael Enright. You seem to have actually modeled your whole personality around a CBC tote bag. And you're still wearing the heavy canvas shirt to boot. So you're actually looking like one today, too. But I'm, anyways, it's a great show.
It is. No, our show or Mike Conrad's show?
Yeah, well, all shows. All shows, but especially ours. I'm super excited today about this one, though.
It is. It's great because you know what? This is the second time we've talked to Mark very recently.
Yes.
The nice thing is on the live event, it was kind of a free-for-all. Questions were coming in. We were all answering them. And he's so knowledgeable when it comes to all things finance. Today, we're talking a little bit more specifically about his recent investment. We'll leave it for the show, but
right.
Between Maine and Canby. Second...
I thought that's not leaving it for the show. But yeah, he's got a great investment.
It's a great investment. He walks through the whole process. Really exciting stuff. So stay tuned for that. But before we get to that, Adam.
Yes.
We got the Oakland tip.
We always have the Oakland tip. And Matt, today, what is the Oakland tip?
So today, the Oakland tip is re-caulking your kitchens and bathrooms is a quick way to spruce up and maintain your home.
Yes, for sure. And you know what? If you are an agent out there and you don't have a good handyman, you should. And if you are a home seller, you should definitely ask your agent if they have a good team of handy people.
That's for sure, because these minor things,
yes.
It's amazing how if you walk into a bathroom and you see just the wear and tear, it's those little things.
Reminds you of home.
It's those little things that remind you of home. You want to be thinking of your best life, not your current life, right?
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
So
sell
these
the
are,
dream.
These are cheap ways to make things look great.
For sure. And you know what? We just did this at one of our listings. A quick story. We actually redid all the caulking in the bathroom and actually along the countertops, like where the tiles hit, just because it was deteriorated. It had aged. It would had a lot of dirt and filth around it. And so we got rid of it. The other thing we had done is we had the cleaners work on the grout. And it's surprising if you just give the cleaners an extra hour to just work on something like making sure all the grout is clean, it changes the way that a unit presents.
Absolutely. Sure. Absolutely. So good tip this week.
Yes.
We also have a tip.
We do, Matt. And in honor of our guest, Mark Ting, we should highlight that the deadline for contributing to an RRSP for the 2019 tax year is March 2nd, 2020.
So, what are we at today? February 25th. That's basically a week away.
That's a week away.
You got a week to top up your RSP.
And Matt, you actually, this is not a tip, but I'm just curious. You just got back from Langford. You were there.
I was on the tour. I went on the tour on Saturday. I went and looked at Pinnacle, this new building right beside Langford Tower. We've had Western Canadian Properties Group on the show before, and Cynthia Aysen was on last week.
Right.
So I went on the tour, a really good turnout. And it was really impressive stuff. You know what? I was up at Fort St. John looking at their construction up there as well. And both times I've been really impressed. And with the rental program and everything else, it just makes a lot of sense. So, yeah, I spent... it's a long day. You go, you get on the 9 o'clock ferry, you leave, and then you come home on the 5 o'clock ferry, which doesn't sound like a long day. But by the end, yeah.
You're tired.
But hey, it was good. It was a nice sunny day in Victoria. A lot of fun.
Okay, great, great. Well, hey, what else do we got? Maybe without further ado, we should cut to our interview with Mark Ting.
Yeah, absolutely. Enjoy, guys.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're here with Mark Ting, partner at Foundation Wealth and guide to personal finance on the CBC's On the Coast with Gloria Makarenko. I think I pronounced that correctly.
You did. Never heard of her.
Welcome back, Mark. You've been on the show a few times. Thanks for coming back.
Yeah, glad to be here.
I think this is a three-peat? Is this your third time on the show?
It's a three-peat. Where's my ring?
That's the five-timers club. Okay. You're gonna have to come back twice more for that. Can you maybe start by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Okay, so I guess my main job is I manage wealth for typically high net worth families and businesses. So we basically take their money, we invest it, and watch it grow and make sure that their financial goals are there, with a focus on preservation of capital as well as tax planning strategies, legal tax planning strategies. Now, on the flip side, we do in the portfolio a decent amount of real estate, but personally, I've always done real estate myself. Started off when I was in high school, and I just bought a place last year and working on that one.
Yeah, well, a lot of people listening will remember you from the Cambodia story, the holiday in Cambodia.
Yeah,
any update on that? Are we done with that, or what's happening?
No, we lost that land, right? It was taken from us. And then we went after the person who sold it because they weren't allowed to sell us something that wasn't theirs because apparently it wasn't ours.
Right.
So they flipped us another piece of land, which we owned, and it's titled properly. But I don't know. Like my friend lives there now, my partner who's dealing with it. He actually lives there full time and he's trying to sort it out.
Oh, so you actually did end up with land in the end.
We got
five-star generals. People should go back and listen to
it's a riveting
levels of corruption involved in this one.
I have no idea where that general is. He got scared away. No, we just don't. We do own a piece of land, but it's like a tiny piece of land compared to what we did own.
Right.
But the value was basically what we paid for it. So we didn't get any of the growth. That was basically stolen. But I got an asset that's worth basically what I paid for. So it's not a win by any means.
Not a lose. Although your time. It sounds like there's a lot of time.
Yeah, it's a story.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm paying. That's the benefit, I guess. I got a good story out of it. But, you know, maybe it'll be a win. I don't know.
Right.
Well, in addition to being somebody who works in finance and also on the CBC, you are an avid real estate investor. And you just actually bought a property recently. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So it was We started looking. Actually, I never look for real estate. It's just one of those things where people come to me and they're like, hey, have you thought about this? And I got a realtor that I work with and he just like, hey, this might be good for us. Because I usually partner up. If you listen to the other podcasts, I always have partners. I never do things on alone. I like to spread my risk. I like to go through it with different people so that we can talk about things, hash things out. And my partners always have a very different skill set than I do. So that's what I look for in partners, because if they're all the same as me, I might as well just do it all myself.
Right.
So in this case, my realtor looked at it. He had another client who was looking at it, and they decided to go with another project, and he approached me about it. So what appealed to me, I guess, was location. So it's close to here. It's in Mount Pleasant. It's between Maine and Cambie, walking distance to the SkyTrain. There's going to be a new SkyTrain down Broadway. We walk the neighborhoods at all times of the day. So morning, day, night, multiple times, rainy, sunny. And the neighborhood just drew me in. It's an awesome neighborhood. Yep. There's a skate park right behind us.
Avid skateboarder as well. Yeah.
Talk to all the neighbors, because I think that's the key to a project right now, because we've had problems with neighbors in the past. So I always make very good friends of our neighbors now, keep them up to date with what's going on, check in with them, and ask them what they thought of the neighborhood. And they loved it. Everybody who was there just loved it. They said, the guy that I spoke to, he rides his bike into downtown, 13 minutes. If he has to take the SkyTrain, you know, 20 minutes at the most.
Right.
So it's kind of the location thing. And in order to get it, though, it had to be due with timing. It also had to do with price. So I guess the main thing for us, the only reason, because this neighborhood's quite expensive and people are building these things up and it's going up.
And it's a single family home?
It's a duplex.
Okay.
So it was a house that was built, you know, 100 years ago, and in the 80s, they cut it. They forced it into a duplex. So it's not a natural duplex. So again, that's another thing. So it's a duplex already. So we bought both sides. It's one house. Plus there's the possibility for a laneway. Everybody else in our neighborhood has laneways. So it's three structures that could be built on this one piece of land. The kicker is, sounds good so far, right?
Yeah.
It's disgusting. You know, it's one of those things where, you know, if it's Halloween, you don't even have to decorate it. It'd scare little kids away. It's, right. You know, it's
a crime scene.
Yeah, it's not pleasing on the eyes at all. But generally what happens, these are the types of projects we go for. We want to go for the ugly duckling in the neighborhood. We got to make sure there's good bones there. Mm-hmm. Because then another consideration is how extensive the city is going to be involved with permitting, that sort of thing. And we determined with this house that the city would be involved. We're going to need permits, mostly on the outside. We're going to have to do some repairs. But the inside, really, it's pretty good. Like, it was renovated in the 80s. I was thinking back, my house is in the 80s as well. So the piping, it's not knob and tube. Everything's been updated. It's just a matter of cleaning it up and defunkifying it and making it look a little bit prettier.
And when did you pull the trigger on this?
I think I was brought to my attention in, I don't know, I'll say in the fall, like early fall, September. And we kicked the tires on this one for months. It wasn't even me who originally kicked the tires, because my friend was working with somebody else. So he was there all the time looking at it and like seeing if there's anything rotten. He literally went there, I'd say 30 times, and spent like an hour, 2 hours each time humming and hawing about it, whether he should do it or not, whether we can bring this together. So I would say we pulled the trigger we finally got a deal done in November and we closed in January. What we looked for and what sort of worked out for us is it all comes down to the numbers for me. I try not to fall in love with anything. And this was an easy one not to fall in love with. Like, yeah. Honestly, like almost every day I was like, I don't need this. Like, this is going to be a lot of work. So we went in with that attitude,
right.
Like almost a defeatist attitude, because we kind of didn't want to do this one. But the price ended up, we were negotiating just with one group and there was no other offers for like months and months and months. And the price went down to a point where like, fine, okay, let's just do this. And then we pulled the trigger on it.
So how long are the timelines for this project then, if you're going through with the city and permits?
Well, like the inside's fine, as I mentioned. So the inside, we just got to paint it, clean it up, So just
and was it tenanted? So the whole place
no,
was tenanted?
No.
Or it was empty?
Well, that's another thing that we looked at, right? So these are all part of the due diligence process. So right now, if we were to look at a property, tenants are hugely important. Like, how long are they going to stay? How long were they there? Because you have all these new rules that are coming through. I have a friend who just bought a house and he's completing in a couple months and he has tenants in there who've been there for like 20 something years. And he had in his contract that it would be vacant. So I don't know. You guys might know better than me, but I was like, I don't know if you could put that in a contract or how you would do that. Like, how do you kick somebody out? Like, so I just cautioned him. I was like, right now, if you have that in a contract that the seller is saying it was going to be a vacant property, then I would really get something in writing, that ended tenancy agreement or something.
Right.
Because there's ramifications if he takes them on. And his idea was, when I think what the realtors were talking about was, well, yes, maybe the tenants would agree to raise the rent to sort of market rent. And then everybody's happy. Tenants get to stay there and you get your market rent and that you can make it cash flow. And I still cautioned him. I was like, look, I'm just telling you the truth. I'm a risk manager and I see risks. Because these tenants were in their 80s and I've heard a lot of stories, you know, sometimes dementia kicks in or like the one person might not be able to be good with the finances and they might not be able to pay you. And then what are you going to do? You're going to try to evict an 80-year-old? Like, it's a really tough situation.
Like a newspaper story.
But that's what he's going for it. So I told him, I was like, look, if they have that deal where you're supposed to get a vacant house, to be honest, like, I would almost want that. I would rather choose my own tenants who go in there so I can be able to predict what I think is going to happen. And the other thing is, if you get new tenants, then that clock sort of starts again, mm-hmm. right? So those 22-year-old tenants, those are tough ones to get rid of, or you might have to pay them off, which is fine. Those are the rules. But why not let the sellers who've agreed to this, they take on that burden as opposed to you take on that burden. And if they do up the rent and they still pay you, that's almost like you saying, okay, I'm going to take them on. And all of a sudden that liability falls on you.
Right.
So mm-hmm. It's a tough decision, right? Because these are real people. But from his perspective, he's not a wealthy man. Like he's fine. But he, in order to make these deals work, he had to have sort of
a certain rent.
Yeah, right? a certain rent. So that's what we're facing. And it's, tenants are a huge consideration.
Yeah.
My place didn't have any tenants. So that's one of the things. Had it been filled with tenants and they're like, you know, like the ones I just described, I probably would have walked away from it. I go, this is going to be way too much of a hassle. I don't like evicting anybody, and I don't want to be in that position. I would probably walk away. But in our case, it was empty.
And so what are the goals here? Is this a long-term hold? Okay, so you're putting tenants in there. Your plan is to kind of rehab and get some tenants.
Yeah, almost every real estate venture I go into, I go into it with a long-term mindset. I've done build and flips before, and I hated it. I was stressed out all the time. I happened to do it at a bad time when the HST was coming out. So HST was coming out, but our house was subject to HST because it wasn't coming out for another year.
Oh, brutal.
And it wasn't a pleasant experience, whereas I like real estate and I like the process. So typically, I think I rather keep things for a long hold. So there's three partners with this one, and there's potentially three units in this house. So I'm thinking maybe 10, 15 years from now, I might even move in there because I do like the neighborhood that much. And when we renovate, we have standards. So we don't do garbage. Our rules are, if we're going to do something, it has to be to where our families would actually be comfortable living there.
Right.
It's not going to be there right away because we have a limited budget, but we're going to focus on the inside. And then ultimately it's the outside is going to be done later. And that worked out with our planning because it takes time working with the city to get the permits. We're working with an architect.
Sure.
And so that we can work on the inside, get it tenanted out, get people living there, and then we can work on the outside.
So if I understand, it's a duplex that you're going to make it, you know, pretty inside.
Yeah.
Get tenants in there, do the exterior, and then build a laneway at a future date.
I don't know about the laneway. The laneway is far, far in the future.
Oh, so there's three units currently then?
No, there's just two. But potentially there's three.
Oh, right.
Okay. So there's all these tax reasons why a laneway might work and might not work. And again, there's three of us. So right now we don't have the means to do the laneway. And it's another project. I don't want to do it, right? I need a break. But I like flexibility. I like having that option. And I remember when I bought my house in Richmond, we had these land use contracts. And one of the main considerations, which no one talks about, like I'm guessing a lot of people who are listening today don't understand what a land use contract is. But what it really meant was my piece of land in Richmond, if I wanted to, I could build as big as I wanted to. They were grandfathered in there.
Right.
And I remember choosing the house that I have, which is a small lot, and another house in another neighborhood, which was a much bigger lot, basically the same price. I liked the house that I have because it was in a cul-de-sac and it was perfect for me. I enjoy small houses myself. I never want to live in a big house.
Yeah.
But I wanted the option, if I ever ripped this thing down, because it's a house in the 1980s, that I could build something bigger, value add. And then what happened was the government took all that land use contracts away, and I was like a little bit upset because had I known that, I could have bought this one, and this one went way higher in price because it was a bigger lot.
Yeah.
So you never know. But these are the things we work with. Rules change as we go along.
Yeah, 100%. One thing I wanted to talk about, I mean, I don't know if there's anything more to cover. It sounds like your due diligence is you do more due diligence than a lot of people I know. I'd love to talk about that. But one thing just before we get there is, so you've done, I know you had a project going in New West. You've done a lot of different projects. Do you work with the same people over and over again? Or are you always looking for new partners? And how do you, you've already mentioned that you're looking for people with different skill sets. Mm-hmm. But can you talk a little bit more about how you find partners? Do you put everything in writing? Like, what is that process look like? And then we can talk about due diligence.
The two partners that I have right now are people I've done deals with in the past. And there's just a ton of trust there. So I won't go into the finances, but basically two of us put up all the money and one person put up nothing. But one person is going to be on title for like a third of the project. So you don't do that unless you really trust somebody.
Yeah.
And again, even though you trust somebody, you still have to paper everything properly because things go wrong and you always have to have those what if type of scenarios. Right. So I mean, there's still promissory notes in there. There's still partnership agreements. What if one person wants to leave before another? All that thing has to be hashed out at the beginning while everybody loves each other, because when people hate each other, that's when things go wrong. And that's what I see in my regular practice too. So I got families that I deal with, often millions of dollars, and then something with a family doesn't go right, second marriage, new kid comes out of the woodwork, whatever. And we have to structure things properly so that when things go wrong, this is very predictable of how things will flow through. Mm-hmm. So do I look for partners? No, right now I'm not looking for, I'm trying to slow down, to be honest, right? Yeah. And I would only do projects that I think that I could trust people completely. And even on this one, the one partner who has the skill set, he's really good at construction. And he has the connections of the trades and everything else, which is another huge
factor. This is the guy that didn't put up any capital.
That's right. So he's putting up sweat equity. And I mean, ultimately, what's going to happen, just to sort of flash forward a couple of months in the future. So now we bought it. We're going to fix it up. We're going to put some money into it. It's going to look decent, nice. And then right now, there's no mortgage on it because we used other lending to buy it. So it's a clear title property. Probably a bank would laugh at us if we asked for money. but in the future, 6 months from now, it'll be a decent property. It'll be like two duplexes, 2-3 bedrooms. And a bank will lend us, we'll say, up to 80%. At that time, then the other people get paid out, and then there's three people on that title, three people on the mortgage, and now it's split equally. Mm-hmm. So it's that initial 6 months, 7 months, that there's a lot of ifs. We're technically, me and my other partner are putting up, are at risk financially because the other person is already on. Mm-hmm. But that's incentive for him, my other partner who doesn't have the financial buy-in to get the project up and running, and we're relying on him for a lot of those things. So that's his skill set. I'm more of the accounting, financial, somewhat due diligence stuff. And my other partner is also a mixture of the two of us. He's also extremely handy. He goes in there, does cabinets. So we do a lot of the work ourselves. Mm-hmm. I go in there on Saturdays and I bring my son and we lay flooring, or we go to the dump and we paint, like just easy stuff.
Yeah.
So if I was to hire myself, I'd only pay myself like $25 an hour, and I'm paying my kid like $10 an hour. Whereas if I had to hire my other partners, they'd probably get about $60 an hour. So it makes sense for them to be working on this project.
Yeah.
Whereas me, where if I pay myself $20 an hour, I'd rather actually foot out the money and pay somebody else.
Right.
You know, $160.
Yeah, somebody else can go to the dump.
Yeah. And then I can get time off because I still need some time off.
Sure.
So those are the different skill sets that we're looking at. We all bring something different to the project. But again, yeah, there is a lot of trust involved. And you learn that trust by doing projects, starting smaller ones, and then gradually building up to bigger ones.
Mm-hmm. Well, in thinking kind of about the goal, are you going to be cash flow positive with this place once you get it up and running?
Yeah, well, that's another rule. Like, we do 100% financing. We don't put any money into our projects.
Right.
And we don't do it unless it's cash flow neutral. Like, I don't really care about the cash flow. Like, when we started off the New West one, it was cash flow neutral. We didn't really make any money. We didn't lose any money. But every month that went by, we had a principal plus interest mortgage payment going in. So technically, we did make money that way. Principal's going down, mortgage's mm-hmm. going down. This one's going to be harder just because prices have gone up that much. But we have to be creative and maximize our asset. And again, there's things you can do to facilitate that. So yes, to answer your question, it will be cash flow, I'll say positive, and probably in a year. Right now, for the first year, it'll probably be cash flow negative. But we might only have to throw in like $500 a month or something.
Right.
It's not, between three of us, another reason I like partners, it's not going to kill us. We each throw in $200 for the next 6 months, and then after that, it should be fine.
So, Mark, other times we've had you on the program, you've been less bullish on the market. Not so much less bullish, but you've taken an approach of kind of wait and see with Vancouver, kind of monitoring the market. Why did you decide to jump back in this past year?
Well, it's a value add, I think. I think this is a project that we found that we knew we'd get a good price on because no one else was bidding on it. So we tend to look for, I'll say, lazy realtors or lazy owners, because it's not always the realtor's fault. But to be honest, like if I own this property when I was selling it, like when he was selling it, had that person only spent 10 grand, 15 grand painting it, maybe defunkifying the smells and things like that, he would have gotten a lot more offers and he would have made 100, probably 200 grand more.
Yeah, he would have saw a good return on that money, that's for sure.
But they refused to do it and it just showed really, really bad. And you needed a specific type of person who could see through that and actually look at the wiring, look at the joints and whatever and see, actually, it's not too bad. We just got to do this, this, and this. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, I looked at it after we spent 15 grand. It looked way, way better. Smelled a lot better. So smells huge, right?
Yeah.
No one wants a stinky house. So there was a deal there. So I wouldn't say I'm overly bullish on the Vancouver real estate market right now. It's gone up quite a bit. I like to buy when it's a buyer's market. And right now it's not a buyer's market. It's a seller's market. So if I'd be more inclined to be on the selling side, although I hate selling real estate, so I probably wouldn't want to be doing that either. This one, like I said, New West, I'm planning on keeping it for as long as I can.
Mm-hmm. And I'm just thinking of timing here. So you got back into the market. You started in the early fall. So the market was starting to pick up a little bit. At that point, we were kind of on that, is this actually a fluke 1 month off or are we sort of seeing a trend? But you actually completed on it in January, but it went firm in December?
November. Yeah.
Okay, so the market was churning pretty good at that point.
Not for this house, though. This house was abandoned. Like we saw other houses that were similar, and they went for like 400 grand more.
Yeah. And this location, I don't know exactly where the house is, but between Maine and Cambie is, you know, a guy just said to me the other day, that's the new Point Grey, right? Like that's where everybody wants to be.
If I had to pick one place to live in Vancouver, it's there.
Yeah.
It's anywhere. I'd rather be there than Point Grey. I'd rather be there than Kits. It's me personally.
Yeah.
Like there's proximity to my office, the restaurants on Main Street. Like I can walk to Main Street in 5 minutes. It's a great location. And it's to me, that's the main thing. It's going to get better. I'm willing to throw in some money, put in the work to get that piece because it's something that I might use in the future. And again, we own the land. We don't have to deal with strata, which I hated doing. We don't have to deal with all these new insurance issues, not nearly as much as them. You know, there's a lot of things that I think it's very beneficial to own a piece of land that is a duplex. Like, I think duplexes are great.
Yeah,
like, it's a great way to get into the market. And then the opportunity for the laneway, that's just another something that's not really icing on the cake, but it's there if we need it.
Better than not having it, that's for sure. Well, it's interesting you mentioned stratas because you just wrote a piece. Do you want to, are you?
Well, maybe talk a little bit about the market just because, I mean, what, if we ask you every time you're on, but what are your thoughts on the market right now? And we kind of, before we got on air, we were talking about some missed opportunities perhaps for buyers and how, at least last time we were talking about buyer's markets are times when buyers should buy. And a lot of them didn't, right? Mm-hmm. And now we're seeing a bit of a pile on in is particularly the entry level price points. But this has been a really busy start to the year.
It's a busy start, yeah, no question.
Yeah, I mean interest rates are going down. That helps. To me, honestly, it comes down to my spreadsheets. Like what I do is I work backwards. I look at all the expenses, like my own personal expenses, what are my fixed costs, and then the cost of the housing. And now I'm putting more focus on those insurance prices because I think that will factor if you are looking at a strata. And I would almost double those and not double the strata, but double your insurance cost and maybe add another 30-40% on your strata when you're doing your due diligence. Mm-hmm. Because essentially if you're going to be renting this out as a revenue property, there's going to be a lot of your expenses that are going to go higher than 2.5%, which you're sort of locked in terms of rent increases. So you have to do your due diligence at the beginning and put those buffers in at the beginning. Now, I'll tell you right now, my spreadsheet's going to tell me that almost every strata building out there is not going to cash flow.
Yeah.
Like it's just not, right? And I have people come up to me and they say, hey, I just bought this. What do you think? And I'll see people who put down 40, 45% and they're still not cash flowing. And to me, that's not a good deal. Like there's an opportunity cost that's lost there. I'd rather do something better with my money or something different, right? Because I understand it, there's two aspects to it. There's the cash flow aspect and the capital appreciation aspect. So then they always ask me, okay, what would you do? And we're going back. I think we were talking about it earlier where we have a lot of people who sit in this chair and they always talk about, okay, why would you invest in the stock market when you could buy something, a hard asset you can feel that produces income and that goes up every year?
Sure. Right.
So I'm like, every time I hear that, I'm like, well, I would do that. Like I do that.
Yeah.
And they always, it's tough to explain that because if people really love real estate, then they're fixated on it and it's a confirmation bias and that's really they go for. So this is how I would explain it. So first off, I love real estate. Second off, it's not an either or. That's what I have to get people's yeah. mind around. There's a purpose for real estate in terms of investment, in terms of retirement planning, and there's a purpose for the market. So I do a hockey analogy. So if you got a hockey team, you would never have a whole bunch of defensive defensemen, right?
Yeah.
You wouldn't. You need a combination of offense, defense in order to win the game, to reach your goals. So I see it the same way. Real estate, we build models. Like I run hundreds of millions of dollars for people. And we build models and they will have real estate in there because there's a purpose for that real estate. Usually it's the defensive guy, the guy I can count on, who's going to give me a point once in a while and it's going to be there when I need it. When things go bad, you want a good solid defenseman. But I also want those high flyer scorers and that's where the market could come in. So there's always like that yin and yang. You don't want all high flying scorers or all defensemen. Otherwise, you're probably going to lose. And then you take it one step further, where is if you got a lead, if you got a whole bunch of scorers and you're going to win this game, well, what do you do? What does a coach do? He probably takes that high flying scorer who might score a lot of goals, but also makes mistakes and puts him on the bench for more time instead of in there
defensively,
and go more defensively. Same with the stock market. Sorry. Same with that, right? So you would, when markets are going really high, well, what do? You take some profits and you put into real estate or something slower and more defensive. And then on the flip side, when you're maybe behind a couple goals, well, you might have to go more offensive. So if markets are down, that's when you take the money from the safe stuff and you go into the more aggressive stuff. And that's how a model works. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of how I explain it. It's like, yeah, real estate's awesome. Like private mortgages are awesome. Like we have those in our portfolio, but we have all these other things that complement it. And I can cherry pick any stock and say, oh, this has done way better than Netflix, up 45% a year. So if you put in $10,000 10 years ago, it'd be worth $370,000. Like those are good returns.
Yeah.
But then of course there's a bunch of other ones that go down, but that's what you get with that. So it's one of those things. So if someone said they had, 50% down payment, they still can't cash flow to me, I'd be like, that's not a good opportunity cost. I would look at maybe a different type of investment. If you really like real estate, REITs, or even private mortgages where you can pretty much get 7 or 8%, there's different things you can do. Mm-hmm. So personally, I do want my children to have real estate and I do think it's a good investment, but it comes down to the deal. And that's amount of the spreadsheet along with what else is out there in terms of opportunity.
So with the people you work with, the kind of basket of investments, right? Can you talk a little bit about, percentages, like how are you structuring that basket, and okay, how would an average person do that? And then secondly, a little bit more about the model, like if you're not, I'm just like curious to hear more.
Yeah. So the first thing, whenever someone's putting together an investment model, the first thing they have to recognize about themselves is they don't have a crystal ball. They don't know what they don't know, and they're probably going to be wrong. Right. What's that saying about forecasts? Like half the people don't know anything and the other half don't know they don't know anything.
Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of like that. So for good advice, you basically have to have like a strategic plan and you got to stick with it and not let your emotionals or your biases get in there. Because when it comes to investing mostly with something that goes up and down, which you can see the daily prices go up and down, that's why real estate's good because you don't really see that. You get emotionally involved and you typically react at the worst time. And studies have shown this.
Yeah.
So I tell people, everything you need to know about investing, your gut will tell you. But the tweak is, you got to do the opposite of what your gut's telling you. So when you think, I got to get in, that FOMO is really ramping up, that's the time you should be like going, okay, chill, take the 10 breaths and really rethink about that. And then when things are really crashing, let's say there's this insurance thing causes a big problem in the condo strata market, and all of a sudden people have to sell or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Then you're like, and your gut's telling you to run away, and you're like, okay, there's that opportunity. So in every crisis, there's opportunity, right? So that's what I'm kind of watching, what's going to happen with this insurance thing, because to me, it's quite interesting. It hasn't hit anything yet. No one's really talking about it too much. But if it does get worse and worse and worse, then I could see there being an opportunity there. Just like the stock market and coronavirus. If coronavirus really gets really worse and then people sell out because they're panicking, well, those are good times to enter. It's not happening. We're actually, I think the TSX set an all-time high today.
Right.
And we're at the peak of the coronavirus. But it could have played out that way. So I don't have a crystal ball.
Or the peak could be a couple months from now when it gets worse.
Yeah, well, you don't know. But like, people will constantly debate about it.
Right.
And forecast, who knows? I don't know. So it's more of a, I'm more of a person who will react to something. And if I see a lot of people panicking, that's where I get really more interested.
Uh-huh.
I don't see a lot of people panicking about real estate right now. So I'm more cautious.
Well, we were just talking, like, we've sold a couple properties this week with $250,000 water deductibles.
Yes.
People aware of that, still buying real estate.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see this playing out, the insurance increases?
You know, see, I don't know, but I think of it on the other side. So going back to that real estate versus stocks, first thing that comes to my mind is like, man, you had seven players in this real estate world, in this insurance world, and now that's down to two, and that's why they're spiking prices. That's basically what's happening, right? There's less competition. So in my mind, I'm thinking I should be investing in those real estate, in those insurance companies. Because it's counterintuitive, but when there's more disasters in the world and all these insurance companies have to pay out, you would think that that would be bad for insurance companies. But it's actually the opposite that happens. Insurance companies' values go up. Because people just accept those new premiums, and you hear that everywhere. I heard it on your show, various other places. Oh, if we got to pay it, we got to pay it. Mm-hmm. 300-400%. Well, who's bringing that money in? And it's changing behavior. The other thing that I keep hearing is that all these stratas, they're going to do whatever it takes not to make a claim.
Yeah, they refuse to make claims.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. So you got someone who's not making claims anymore, and that's paying like 300-400% more.
Right.
I'm like, where do I want to be in this trade? I'm thinking it's a good time. Well, this is not investment advice, but I would be looking at, you know, maybe this is an insurance. Insurance companies are something that people could be thinking about.
Right.
So that's why there's always the other side of the table. And that's sort of how I look at it. Whether how it's going to play out, I have no idea. I'm watching it. I'm curious about it.
Do you think this could just lead to better buildings and building practices in a lot of ways? Because I'm thinking about like auto insurance, right? I mean, the seatbelt and a lot of the stuff that came in that was a safety mechanism was a result of the insurance industry demanding it, right? And if you think about just the way building practices are, I mean, it would probably be in the best interest of a developer to take extra measures to prevent leaks or to prevent better piping or plumbing.
Well, not only that, any inspection you ever go to, right? The first thing before you even walk in, the inspector goes, all right, the rubber hoses to the laundry, you want to change those. But it's crazy that I was just in a brand new building and it's like for $5 more, they could put in the braided.
Yeah.
And they don't.
Braided steel,
like, yeah. It's like nuts. Like that type of thing is.
But you're right. Stratas are going to move towards that. But I wonder if there's a, I'm just thinking out loud, but I wonder if there's a real opportunity for a developer to spend a bit more and to market around the fact that you know, we've got this as leak-proof as possible.
Yeah.
This building, right?
I can see that happening. People will pay a premium for it. And it's not hard to do. Like I think of it all the time. It's like it's just shutoffs. Or they do it with fireproofing all the time. We can we can contain it to these floors.
Well, that's containing it is, I think, a big thing, right?
And that's what I imagine. If a developer went in there and saying, oh, these are the extra things we're doing, so you don't have to worry about that. And sure. Insurance companies will react to it because insurance companies do give you discounts for alarms and various other things, your proximity to firehouses. It's all risk-based. Right. What we do in our houses is we never reuse anything. Like if we see a coil, even if it's braided, we're like, oh, I'm replacing that.
Yeah.
It's $5. I'd rather just have sure that security. We typically, we're a little bit different because we can fix anything. So we're not making claims unless it's horrendous.
Yeah.
So we insure against like big fires, big tree falling on us, but floods and things like that, because we're not in a strata building, which is our own building, we can go in there and fix that. We tell our tenants always anything to do with water. I don't care if you did something stupid. I don't care if you took a big poo and it's coming back up. We'll be there. Don't try to fix it yourself.
Yeah.
And that's happened. And every time they do, even if it's like late at night, we get there, we fix anything to do with water, and we thank them for it. It's like, good call. Thanks for doing that. Could have been a lot worse.
Well, I feel like I've told this story 1,000 times on the show, but I had a tenant who didn't want to bother me, right? And
yeah.
It's like, I went there and it's like, it was like I was in a rainforest. Like, it was nuts. There'd been water damage like for months. Like,
had to rebuild the house.
Yeah.
Water for months.
No. Well, like literally it was my basement suite was like, I hadn't been in, I was on vacation. I got back. I said, how is it? I knew there was a leak. He said, I don't think it's that bad. And then I went down there. I was like, okay, this was not an A. It hasn't been a new, like the walls are green. Like this is nearly, and it was moist, like in that way where you're, you know, it was like Park in the middle of January. Like,
well, it felt also like,
and he was like, no, I didn't want to bother you.
We were talking about it at the time too, because he was from a part of the world that where a lot of concrete construction, right? Different kind of drain systems.
Right.
I mean, that's the other thing too. I mean, if you're not used to drywall and wet drywall and laminate floors and stuff like that, you might not recognize the signs of a leak bubbling, the same way.
It was just you.
But anyways, that was Matt's yeah. experience.
But now, yeah, I mean, that was a kind of there was an educational component that I think I've implemented since that you're talking about. That
yeah, you got to train your tenants.
Yeah,
and they're just trying to be nice and helpful. But here's the line: this is when you're not being helpful.
Yeah.
Anything to do with water, it's not a problem. Just call us.
Yeah,
and that's. Water's a pain in the ass, and it can get anywhere. You can start over on one side of the house, and it finds places. It can be on the other side of the house. So it's something that if you can get it quickly, you can save yourself a lot of hassle.
Right,
right, right. I feel like there's a lot to unpack with just the condo insurance thing.
Yeah, maybe we should stick on
just
that.
A little bit more here. But so, I mean, I guess if I understand what you're saying, there might be – If you're somebody that watches the market, and it feels like this insurance thing will get worked out to some extent, but there might be an opportunity based on people that are fearful of it. And there might, we could see a shift where sellers move to I want out of this. There's too much risk. There's too much liability, especially if they're self-insuring, right?
Right. Which a lot of people have to be right now.
Well, this is it, right?
I think that eventually the market will solve this. Like if two players are making that much money, well, then another player is going to come in and then there's going to be more competition. I don't think the fear is there yet. I don't see it at all. As I wrote that article and I got lots of comments, I was like, oh, I didn't know this was happening. So I don't think there's like a opportunity or a crisis right now. Like, but if I was a buyer and I had those $600,000 deductible or something like that, I would be like, I don't know if I want to buy this place. Like, well, I would actually walk away, and I imagine other people, once the story becomes bigger, and then people always have to sell at some point, like estate sales or whatever, and then I could see those prices going down. And eventually, well, if I go down far enough, that could be an opportunity for somebody.
Well, also, like, I'll try and work this out in my thinking here, but have the gaps between home ownership in the condo market and in the detached market just narrowed significantly? Because when you think about, say, like an insurance company like Sonnet, I think it's Sonnet, or Foursquare, I think is still doing the really high deductible coverage. Do your own due diligence on that. But I think they are still covering
really significant deductibles for, mm-hmm. for personal insurance. But if it just becomes, you know, that obviously now your premium is going to go up as an individual homeowner and you could be spending another $2,000 on insurance coverage mm-hmm. per year for condo insurance. So if you think about all these increasing costs, your strata insurance premium going up, your own personal insurance premium going up, your maintenance fees going up over time, at what point are your carrying costs, you know, at what point do people start to say, I want to move to either smaller buildings that are maybe, or smaller, something like a duplex, mm-hmm. right? Or stretch to get into the detached just because potentially my carrying costs are lower.
That's my thoughts anyways. Like I do own a strata building. Mm-hmm. I own a townhouse and our premiums went up a bit. I think our strata fees only went up like 5%, which is kind of in line.
Yeah.
And our deductible went from like $5,000 to $25,000. But I was thinking about it. I'm fine with that. I'm actually happy with that. Because, and the reason why is because it's a townhouse. No one's above us. No one's below us. So it's risk-based, right? So if I was a new buyer and I was like, okay, there's this townhouse over here, or there's this condo in this 50-floor building.
Right.
But like them both, like my instinct would be like, because of everything you just mentioned, I want to go for that one, the townhouse, mm-hmm. just because this insurance thing could be a problem. And I don't know, right? It could balloon out or it could go away in 6 months. Who knows?
Well, everyone says houses are more expensive to live in. And I mean, the reality though is like you've put a roof on your house recently, but you've gotten away with, you've been fair. I've had some more dings with my home ownership, but you've done quite well.
I wrote back when we were aspiring to write blog posts on our website.
We're still aspiring.
We are still aspiring. But I wrote a blog just looking at carrying costs for kind of entry level homes in East Vancouver versus townhomes in East Vancouver, and the carrying costs without the maintenance fee and with the tenant. You know that there's the sticker shock, I guess, but it's not all that much different. But actually, the carrying costs were, I think it was actually worked out to be, you know, easier to carry at a $1.5 million versus a $1.1 on the townhome or something like that. It was a couple of years back when I was really putting the energy in. Yeah.
We'll have a link in the show notes.
I mean, it goes back to what I bought though, right?
Right.
It's a duplex, two, three bedrooms. And I was thinking in the future, that's going to be affordable for a family, right? Mm-hmm. So you got, again, I didn't know about this insurance thing when I bought it, but the idea when we bought that place is like, who's going to live here? Who could live here? And it's super flexible. You could have wealthy people or you could have just regular families. There's like so many different things depending on what we do there. Mm-hmm. And then I looked at, okay, who can afford it? Because affordability is a big thing. Well, people will pay a premium for being close to the city center. We know that closer to transit, these are all things we like, but you're paying for it. So Vancouver is going pretty high-end tech. So I could picture a lot of people when we're thinking about, when we talked about maximizing income for tenants. So one of the things we're thinking about is we've approached Amazon, we've approached a couple other places and saying, hey, look, do you want to have access to this place? And because you're going to have people in here for maybe a year or two, because typically that's what it works. So these are well-paid professionals. They come to Vancouver, they want a nice place to live. And then after 2 years, if they stay, they usually buy something. So it's generally, if we wanted to give them that leeway, this is an opportunity for them. Or it could be anybody, but I could imagine someone renting out or even buying that place in the future, a three-bedroom duplex. It will be affordable compared to a single-family home or mm-hmm. maybe some of these other condos. Mm-hmm. So again, it's all about flexibility, who can do what. We're going to be furnishing these places. We're going to be doing a bunch of things like that to try to maximize rents.
Interesting.
Do you approach a lot of, like, so maybe talking about kind of how you're approaching filling these tenancies. And so is that a strategy of yours? Are you actually reaching out to mm-hmm. bigger companies in the city and trying to arrange for?
Yeah. And it hasn't worked yet.
Okay.
But I'm always trying to figure out ways, what markets are underserved. So, and who might have to pay a little bit of a premium. So I love renting to people with dogs. I think they're great. They tend to be awesome tenants. Dogs, I got the biggest dog in the world and he doesn't do that much damage besides taking up most of the bed. You know, I think kids and other things cause more damage. So I have no problems with dogs. So I usually we rent out to people with dogs and they're appreciative and we don't screw them on the rents, but you know, there's always a little bit of a premium there.
Sure.
Another underserved place would be sort of temporary workers. So again, you look at, you're reactive. So you got these rent evictions that are happening and you have all these rules, and a lot of people will have to move out of their house for 6 months to a year. And then they have the opportunity, right of first refusal, often to go back, or they might have to move out for a little bit. And I'm like, well, who's going to rent to these people? Very few people. Mm-hmm. Who's going to rent for 6 months? So we're like, okay, I will.
Yeah.
And then we get people in for 6 months. It might not be ideal for them. It might not be like big enough for them, but they'll manage it for 6 months. And then they go back to their old apartments. Students, those types of people, they often don't want to sign a 1 year lease, and they're happy to rent for 6 months. So we're open for anything. So other people will come in, they'll just regular people sign the lease for a year, and they'll live there for a year or two and then go month to month. That's fine as well. But we'll also open it up to these other people, and they might be like a room share type of a thing. So you're living with two other strangers, mm-hmm. but they're all students and they're all working or something. So we do our due diligence. We look at their backgrounds. We have quite a lot of experience working with people who are here for a year, and when we find they're awesome tenants. They're never home.
Yeah.
Like they go there, they sleep, and then they're out doing activities every weekend or they're working, and they don't really bump into each other all that much. So it's perfect for them. We can charge a little bit more in rent, and I don't know, serves a need.
Mm-hmm. So maybe shifting gears a little bit, Mark. So what about for, like, you bought in Mount Pleasant West, an area where it can be Mount Pleasant kind of area where prices are fairly high already. Mm-hmm. What about for somebody who's kind of getting into the market? Do you have any areas in the Vancouver, greater Vancouver region that you're kind of excited about for kind of a new investor?
Yeah, I mean, it all comes down to the budget, right? So new investors, I often say, just show me the deal and tell me why, mm-hmm. right? So transit, I think, is going to be huge. Parking's not that big of a deal anymore. People don't really care about that. So if you can, closer to the city center, you're probably, it's a less riskier option, because if there's going to be a rocket in the market, it's going to be on the outliers, and then the middle part will be more insulated, unless something like this insurance thing really causes a big hiccup. So with the question I often, so to answer your question, I don't really know. It's like, I would like to see the deal. And I always tell people, it's like, they say, oh, can you give me your opinion on this? And I always flip it to them. It's like, no, you tell me why you want to buy it. And then they list it off, and then I'll play devil's advocate. And it all depends on where they work, what they're going to do, if they're going to work from home or various other things.
What about like in moving kind of broader to BC or the rest of Canada? Do you have any other markets that you're kind of keeping an eye on?
I still like certain areas. Like I still like New West. I mean, it's one of my favorite places. If it's more of the deal though, I'm sort of repeating myself, but yeah. I go after houses no matter where they are. If they tick all my boxes, and generally it's those houses that have the lazy realtor, lazy owners, and that scare off everybody. And that's why I can get the price. And I don't deviate from the price. We got that place for under 1.5 million. And in that neighborhood, that's a really good price. It gave us opportunity to invest more money.
How big was the lot?
I don't know. It's 30 by 120. It's pretty big. It's enough to put a big laneway house in the back.
That's a good deal.
Yeah. But
good value for the land.
It wasn't. So we did that. That was one of the due diligence things. So I talked to my developer friends. I was like, hey, swing by this place and tell me what you think. What would you pay for it? And he gave me a price. And he goes, if I was to rip this place down, this is what I'd pay for it. And it was pretty close to what we paid. Like, it was only like $50,000 less. That's where I knew we had a pretty good deal, because right. Someone ripped it down. It's a little bit odd lot. It's like, it's long, but it's like 28 and a half wide or something like that. So it's a little bit narrow. So developers like their 30 because they could just shove what they know on there, and it's easy enough to do.
Yeah.
When we did our due diligence, the other thing that I highly recommend is I brought all my trades in. Like I don't know what I don't know. Like I've said that before. It's like, guy who's going to have to fix the roof, what do you think? Person who has to deal with the balcony, like, what's this going to cost me? I brought them all in, and they're poking and prodding and all those things, so that I had as many data points as I could before I actually came up with the price I would be willing to pay.
So there, a lot of things have to do that level of due diligence, though, a lot of things have to line up, right? You have to be the only offer. You have to negotiate longer terms or longer subject period to bring people through. Or were you doing this before you tied it up? Were you bringing through?
Oh yeah. So what?
But you must have been pretty confident that there is nobody else kicking around, right?
Yeah. If you saw the place, you'd know why. But that's what I mentioned. We went there like 30 times and various different times. Yeah. The realtor hated us because we kept on calling him back, right? The other thing that a lot of people neglect is go into the city. We went to the city several times, and we found out some things about this property which were not disclosed. But once we discovered them, we brought them up, and they were fixed. Mm-hmm. So again, go to the city. You had the guy about the oil tank. We put that in our contract. So he did the oil tank scan himself. And if I was a seller, I would do the oil tank scan myself, because I would do kind of the cheaper one.
Oh, yeah. Right? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Metal and detector.
Yeah. I would do that.
Not literally by himself, but
Right, right. Yeah. No, the cheaper version of it. Yeah. An official one, but here's the cheaper one so that the buyer feels comfortable. But as a buyer, I'm paying the $400.
Yeah.
I'm getting in there. Nothing came of it, but I had it in my contract that anything did come to it, all the liability. Like we had that much, like a whole paragraph saying it's going back to you guys.
Yeah.
So there's due diligence is really important. Don't talk to the city, talk to your trades if it's not a turnkey one, and get your pricing right.
What, maybe as I just have two questions. One, what are the biggest risks? So the market seems to be heating up here in a way that feels familiar. And I think it's largely interest rate related, I would say, as a huge factor, right? Part of it, lack of inventory, cheap borrowing costs.
People that sat on the sidelines coming back.
Yeah. What are the biggest risks to the market in 2020 as far as you can tell? And where are we at the end of this year?
Well, forecasts.
Take out your crystal ball.
No. Let's do risks first.
I understand your question. Yeah. So what will tank the market, or where we're going to go into correction? We'll go for that. I'm not saying it's going to happen this year or next year, but this is when we hit a recession. So we get a recession, what happens? Well, we got a lot of migrating workers here. All these people in the construction industry, a lot of them are not locals. They're coming from Calgary. They're coming from back east and stuff. So if that starts drying up, well, they're not staying. They're going, right? They're going to go where the job is. And then we're so dependent on construction in our economy that will have a factor. And all of a sudden, a lot of people are going to leave. That'll be great for renters, because now there's a lot more options out there. But in terms of buyers, a lot less. And I would say that a lot of people underestimate the amount of people that do this. And then the other side is, well, if there is a recession, what's that mean? It means that there's layoffs, people don't get paid as much, costs still remain the same, they still keep going up. So less people are buying, some people will be forced to sell, and then you'll see a normal correction in the market. That's what recessions do. The markets never go up. They always go in cycles, and that's a recessionary cycle. So I think those are the two things that will happen. Now, if you're asking me when I think a recession will hit, I don't think it will be hit this year. One of the main reasons is it's an election year in the U.S. Central banks are pumping in so much money, and as long as they're pumping in that money, which is literally pinching money, throwing out the economy, even if it's not working all that well, as long as that happens, it's really hard to get a recessionary. Right. Recessionary is when assets price spike, interest rates go up, and that's not happening. They're going down. But, coronavirus could play a factor. It's definitely going to slow global growth. And if that gets really, really bad, then there could be a recession. But those are what ifs. I generally tell people, don't try to predict these big drops or these falls in the markets. Just be prepared for them. And that's why you have your defensemen. That's why you have your private mortgages and your real estate, for just in case there is a recession, where real estate in REITs, like in the bigger players, they tend to do a lot better. But in markets like this, well, that's when there could be some selling pressure. Seller's market.
Right. So in terms of a percentage of increase or decrease, December 2020.
Okay, what are we talking about? Condos or what? My house will be up 100%. Don't know about yours. You got a leaky bathroom.
Yeah. Well, we'll leave it there. Matt's house down, Mark's house up. Well, thanks a lot for taking the time today. And how can people find out more about what you're doing?
I got a pretty good web presence, I guess. If you Google my name, Mark Ting CBC, Mark Ting Foundation Wealth. I'm doing a podcast too.
Oh,
great. I've actually done it already. It's for UBC alumni. I recorded all the shows. Those will be coming out later this year. So if you need to find me, it's pretty easy. Twitter, Google my name. I'm out there, and my contact information's everywhere.
Google them.
And as an aside, I don't know if I told you this last time. I was talking with some parents at the school that my daughter goes to, and they said, "So you have a podcast? Who do you talk to?" And I was trying to think of people that we've talked to that they might know. And I mentioned your name, and oh man, you got some real fans out there. It was
it's good, nice to hear.
Fans of you, fans of Gloria. I'm a fan of Gloria as well.
I'm a huge fan.
Yeah, she's great.
She warms my car. her voice. Well, thanks again.
We got the five Mark. Wire.
Oh yeah, five we do wire. Have the five wire. Yeah,
you gotta sorry. Think well, if Mark can come up with some new answers here because I think he's done it before.
So favorite neighborhood, Mark.
Well, we'll just go easy with that one. We'll say Mount Pleasant.
All right.
The more time I've spent there, the more I've fallen in love with it.
Man, taking the boy out of Richmond.
Yeah, I'm still in Richmond for the next 10 years, and we'll see how this one goes. I love Richmond, too.
Favorite bar or restaurant? I feel like I'm trying to remember your last one. I think it was like a diner.
I was thinking about this one because I knew you were going to ask me, and I thought I'd go with the Cambodian theme. So, you know Phnom Penh Phnom Penh and Chinatown? That place is amazing every time I go there. Huge lineups, but so good.
The lineups are insane.
It's worth the wait.
Some of the best lineups out there.
It is.
I don't line up for anything anymore. I'm too old for this crap. Yeah. But that one I will line up for.
And is it right across from Kisa Tonto? It's very, very close. So many good restaurants.
Yeah, that street is completely being revitalized.
Yeah, very good. What is one piece of advice that you
No,
give
no, no,
your...
the book. We're oh, missing. Yeah. We don't well, have it written well, down.
Yeah, and I don't, my memory is gone. But what is one book that you would recommend to our listenership?
So I'm going to be teaching at SFU in the spring. And I had to reread a whole bunch of books to start from the basics. And the one that's still as impactful as ever, I think, is The Wealthy Barber. Like I read that when I was 18, the original one.
Yeah, yeah.
I read it again over the winter, and I think it's great. It's something that's really good advice. Talks about all that behavioral investing. I think everybody should read it. It's like a, you could read it in like 3 hours.
Yeah. You know what? I read that when I was too young.
We also, we hung out with David Chilton night, and he's an awesome guy.
He was a fun guy.
Had a beer with him. Yeah. He's a good guy.
Yes.
Smart guy. Super
Actually,
bright.
He signed a couple books for us.
Yeah. And then we proceeded to lose them, unfortunately.
I don't even think they made it home.
Yeah. For another podcast, Matt.
Okay. So yeah, that's actually good. I think I'll revisit that book. I haven't thought about that one for a while. Piece of advice you tell your 18-year-old self, presumably around The Wealthy Barber.
No, not at all. Learn a trade. Like 18 years old, if you know electrical work, plumbing, basic plumbing work, basic drywall, if you just know how to do these things, you'll save yourself so much money. I have tons of trades out there that are billing themselves out at like $90 an hour.
It's like they're surgeons.
Well, and it's because they don't want the work.
Yeah.
They're like, they're busy and they're like, okay, fine. I'm going to bid this at super high. And then they're going to say no. And then they get it and they're like, well, it's $90 an hour. I might as well do it. But if you know how to do that stuff, you can save yourself so much, or you can at least negotiate better. You're like, you know what the value is of that work. Mm-hmm. So I would definitely like watch the YouTube videos, get your hands dirty. My son is, like I said, he's laying down flooring. He's learning on the glue and he's cutting things. And
how old's your son?
14. But I want him to learn this stuff because I don't want to take care of him.
You also want to save on your construction costs.
It doesn't save me anything.
It's bonding.
It takes more time.
At $10 an hour, you better learn this stuff.
It's more of me not wasting my time, but teaching him actually.
No, but that's a great one. I love that.
Yeah.
Young people out there, learn a trade.
No kidding. Last question. God, I'm blanking on the 500.
$500.
Yeah, no, it's $1,000. And we've bumped it up. The threshold is $1,000. So something that you would buy under $1,000 or that you've bought recently that has had a positive impact on your life.
I like a deal. So I'm only spending $250. And what I did, so I'm going to Sri Lanka in a couple months. And what I did was when I go to Sri Lanka, I'm renting a tuk-tuk. So I got my driver's license in Sri Lanka, and I'm renting a tuk-tuk for 2 weeks, and I'm going to be driving around. I got no plans.
Yeah.
I got not booking any hotels, no nothing. I'm just going to be driving my tuk-tuk all around Sri Lanka, going to surf.
Are you going with your family, or is this?
No, just going by myself. I got a friend joining me.
But how do you get that hall pass?
I get that hall pass every year.
So how long are you going for?
Just 2 weeks.
So 2 weeks, you've got your driver's license.
Yeah.
Man, you know what?
Is it an international driver's license?
No. It's a Sri Lankan driver's license. Wow. So I'm getting my Sri Lankan driver's license. I got to learn. I can drive standard. I can drive motorcycles. Yeah. But the tuk-tuk has a different way. If you don't know what a tuk-tuk is, it's a three-wheeler thing where usually in Southeast Asia where people use them as cabs. They're
popular in Thailand.
Yes. Yeah. But think how cool that will be. So one of the good things about traveling, if I'm going by myself, is I don't like doing things by myself. I rather hang out with people. And if I'm going around all these places, and I'd be like, hey, I'm going there too. Hop in the back. We're going. So it's so easy to just meet friends, meet people. I think I haven't spent it yet, that $250. I put the deposit down. But I can pretty much guarantee you it's going to be a phenomenal experience. So I think that's going to be the best $250 I've ever spent. For a while.
Are you avoiding the urban centers? Because I'm just thinking all the tuk-tuk cities that I've seen, it's chaotic.
No, if you know Sri Lanka, there's a couple big cities, but almost all the cool stuff is pretty much out of those.
Okay.
So you could actually go on safari where you're just driving your tuk-tuk down the road and you'll see wild elephants walking around and things like that. That's quite common.
Wow.
And then once you get to various different places, there's all these hiking. And then all along the coast, Sri Lanka has some of the best surf in the world.
Mark Ting just won
the best
question number five we've ever had on the show, I think.
Yeah.
That was great.
I'm honored.
That actually sounds like an unbelievable trip. We'll have to have you back on just to talk about that.
To tell us about the tuk-tuk.
Yeah, no kidding. Also, just as an aside, you must be a real efficient guy. SFU, podcast, partner, CBC.
Tuk-tuk operator.
you drive a Sri Lankan cab. Yeah.
Exactly.
I love the side hustle. What can I say?
Well, thanks so much for your time. It's definitely appreciated that you come back.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. It was great.
So there you have it, folks, our discussion with Mark Ting, partner at Foundation Wealth and CBC's financial guru. I don't think they actually call him that, but that's what we call
him. I know, because we always forget guide to personal finance. But now we got to add guide to tuk-tuk, guide to Thailand.
That was kind of incredible. Eh?
Yeah.
I feel like every time Mark Ting surprises every time. And that's in this one, it was that he has his tuk-tuk license and he's going on a trip by himself.
It's crazy.
To drive a tuk-tuk around
Surf's up for Mark Ting. I appreciate him bringing up that story because that was actually, really, every once in a while you think Mark Ting works really hard, right? He's so engaged. Even at the live event, he came straight from the office.
Yeah.
He hung around, he worked, he's got kids, he's a busy guy. He's
teaching at SFU now.
He's looking for real estate opportunities.
He's writing articles for the CBC. I mean,
he's a busy, busy guy. So then you think, well, when does Mark Ting get a moment to himself?
When does he study for the tuk-tuk exam?
Well, not only that, but I'm like, man, how does he decompress? And it turns out in the most creative way possible.
Yeah, no kidding. And also,
taxi driver in Asia.
most people are like, I want to stare into least myself.
Stare at a wall.
Not talk to anyone for a week.
Fetal position, crying.
Mark Ting, it's incredible. Anyway, really interesting stuff with Mark, and that investment sounds great. So hopefully everybody enjoyed that. What else do we got this week, Adam?
What else do we got, Matt? Well, of course, we have our YouTube channel where
it has basically all of our live events. So Vancouver Real Estate Live. You can search for our YouTube channel at Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. And of course, huge shout out to Ramey from Ramey Films, who's been helping us with the live events.
They're beautiful.
And he's doing our video marketing. And Ramey is also doing other live events. They're awesome.
And I would almost argue if Mark Ting's a financial guru,
Ramey's
a creative guru.
He's the beautiful film guru.
And the creative guru.
Yeah.
He came up with the idea.
He did come up with the idea. He approached us, and now our live events are some of my favorite things we do.
And just going back to the Langford tour I was on Saturday, tons of people turned up, really great stuff. And I just wanted to point out there's still some units available at for Pinnacle, that building with the rental program.
Seemed really to be selling quickly, though.
Like after the weekend, I mean, but I believe there's still a couple, and they're all in rescission still.
Yep.
So some might come available. If you are interested in kind of that 300K turnkey investment brand new on the island, get in touch.
For sure. And I also want to say just one, because we friend of the show, Corey Wright, who's a commercial broker, fantastic commercial broker.
He's been on a live event.
Who's been on our show several times, actually had flipped us a project for industrial space in Langford, a pre-sale that sold out in, I think, just over a week.
Yeah.
So well,
it's the fastest growing community in BC.
Yeah, and stuff is really moving there. So we are definitely, a lot of deals are coming across our desks for Langford. So if you are interested, for sure, reach out. And also head over to our website, VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Head over there because we got tons of resources. We also got things like the Livewire. That's our weekly newsletter. We're sending out stats before anyone else. We're sending out stats that no one else is sending out. So if you want submarkets, that's a place you sign up. We got the deal of the month. We also got private client services.
We do, Matt. And if you are not using PCS, you are standing still while the rest of us power walk by. You get sold prices, days on market. You basically get realtor level information at your fingertips. It's free. It's available on our website. And trust us, we've used every search engine for real estate in the Metro Vancouver area, and nothing compares.
That's right. If you're not using private client services to search Vancouver real estate, you're doing it wrong. And last, before we go, Adam, last week we kind of tongue-in-cheek said there's so many people, not so much tongue-in-cheek actually,
right,
that are unaware that we actually are realtors working in the Vancouver area. And a friend of the program, longtime friend of the program, actually, Will got in touch. He's looking to sell his place. I'm meeting with him for a drink tomorrow to discuss. And I just thought, you know what? It's worth pointing that out. We help a lot of people buy and sell real estate, but people are for some reason, you know, we're not just too...
They think this podcast keeps the lights on, and trust me, it doesn't.
That's absolutely correct. So if you want to talk about that or anything else, give me a call, 778-847-2854 or Matt at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Or you can try me at 778-866-4574 or Adam at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
We also got that secret line.
info@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Why is that light off? Have a great week, guys.
Take care.
2,000 Faces for Radio. Subscribe today.